Accession number 28354, Reel 20.
Sir William, was that Air Force officer's, as a senior officer, was his attitude unusual?
Yes, I think it was. Unusual is not quite the right word. It was exceptional. The same sort of thing did occur. And the reason for this, I think, is the Air Force is a very centralized administration. The top. It was from the top. With a lack of decentralization. I always found that, you know, group captains commanding airfields and things didn't seem to have the initiatives available or the liberty available to do things that captains of ships would do or captains of shore establishments would do or captain of a naval air station might do. The headquarters was very, very important. Sleepy Hollow, they call my headquarters. There was a difference. this is an Air Force officer who's terribly sensitive of his real estate and his the things that were his. Now we are. He's a great. Rochford Hughes is a great yachtsman, and we did cooperate nobly on one time, trying to rescue an Italian yachtsman who got lost on a rock in the Indonesian islands, and we sent ships and aeroplanes and everything in a coordinated search for this chap. He was popular because he played the piano in the Mandarin Hotel in Hong Kong. So we did cooperate there. No, it wasn't. Talking of the senior officers, of course, the commander-in-chief was General Sir Michael Carver. And I'd seen him when he was a major general in that short time in Hermes. And then one heard stories about Michael Carver. Obviously, the army did not care for him. He was the man that started amalgamating regiments when the army had to reduce one time, and that made him very unpopular. And he was such an extremely tough and unsympathetic sort of operator. So I was a bit fearful coming out as to what this commander-in-chief was going to be like. And I enjoyed my time with Michael Carver enormously. I thought he's a wonderful man. And as long as you were absolutely straight and honest with Michael, he was straight and honest with you. He's just a very good, able senior officer. He wasn't perhaps as sympathetic to people's failings as one might like to be, but he was a good man to work for. What was so interesting is that Michael had a slight speech hesitation. You never noticed it, except that when he got a bit rattled or when he saw that he was losing an argument, this slight hesitation was evident in his speech. And it always gave me pleasure when we were having some dust-up on some disagreement, which obviously happened, when the stutter came in. I said, I'm winning. And it usually was so. But he was a very good CNC indeed. I've always felt very sorry for his general, who was the man called, not sorry for him, but sympathetic towards him, who was Tom Pearson, who was a very, very nice general indeed. I love Tom. Because Michael Carver had commanded the Far East Land Forces before he bumped up to being commander-in-chief. So he knew everything about every bit of Tom's army. And did slip into the did fall for the temptation very often as CNC to organize and order around Tom's army when Tom should have been doing it. And Tom was very patient. Now let's go on with other places. I visited Bangkok quite often.
And you're able to do this, of course, because you have this so superbly run
Yeah, well,
back office, really.
I felt it was superbly run, yes, indeed. Yes.
Was the policy that you adopted in being out on the stump, if I may put it that way, in political terms, touring your domain, was that something that many commanders far east
did? They all did it. You always had to, get around, and you had to meet compact fleet, the commander of the Pacific Fleet in Honolulu, and you had to meet the New Zealanders and Australians, because you had Australian and New Zealand ships under command always. There were two Australian destroyers and at least one, sometimes two, New Zealand frigates under command. So one had to liaise with them and discuss with things with them. And otherwise, confrontation was over. One had to make friends with the Indonesian Navy. Malaysia was alongside. Their Navy was just growing up, and we were commanding it. The officers seconded to do so. So it was very much, they very much looked at that time to the Royal Navy as the big brother, so to speak, who would help them, and did. Thailand looked very much still to the Royal Navy. Its Navy was based. Its whole structure was very much British, and of course the Japanese Navy structure was totally British originally. So there were lots of navies around the place wanting to see you anyway, wanting to talk to you. At least I think they were. And we went around. Now quite early on, I planned to go to Australia and New Zealand, but unfortunately, that visit coincided with the 1967 decision to leave the Far East. And Australia and New Zealand weren't too pleased about this at the time, so it didn't seem the propitious time to go down. And that was a blessing in disguise to my wife and I, because we suddenly found we had a blank week, and we got into an aeroplane and went to Cambodia, and went and had the most wonderful sightseeing week of our lives at Angkor Wat. That was wonderful, and I'm so pleased to have had that experience. We did subsequently later go to Australia and New Zealand in 1968 sometime, and this we did in tremendous luxury. The RAF gave us a Comet to go around in. Well, my wife and I and my daughter, who came with me, only needed about three seats in that Comet, and there were a lot left over. So we took a lot of people on holiday around New Zealand and Australia. I had quite a job to get that Comet, actually. The Undersecretary for the Navy, because he had to do the sums anyway and was looking at the bottom line, no doubt, and the cost that the Navy would have to pay the RAF for the use of this aeroplane, he wasn't keen to let me have it, but eventually I got it. And that was lovely. We flew first to Auckland, and there was a Commodore up there, and we saw the New Zealand Naval Base in Auckland, and met all those people there and discussed everything we discussed with them. And then Laurie Carr was the chap's name. Laurie then took us in a car right the whole length of the North Island from Auckland down to Wellington, Rikitangi, I think it's called. It doesn't matter where there was a wireless base, and we stayed a night there at their communications centre. And on south, where I met the Chief of Naval Staff of the New Zealand Navy, who was the man who had been Captain of Royalists when we all went to Tokyo together in 1958 when I was Captain of Cheviot. It was nice to meet him again. And there was the usual social and business things there. I can think of no problems of any great difficulty that we discussed to make it particularly notable. And from Auckland, we'd refueled at Darwin, and then spent a night at Brisbane. So I've met to a lot of places, and stayed in a suite of rooms in a hotel in Brisbane that had a... I wanted to add to the plaques outside it. One of the plaques was LBJ stayed here, and I wanted to put a WDOB did as well. I didn't think we could do that. Anyway, down in... from Wellington, we went to Sydney, where I stayed with a Rear Admiral Wells, who was a flag officer in Sydney, and saw their naval base there.
What was your impression of the Australian and New Zealand naval operations?
Well, New Zealand was very tough. I was worried for the New Zealand Navy losing the Royal Navy, because it's so small. It only had four frigates, and they really relied on being with the bigger brother, so to speak. And I worried that they wouldn't really be able to keep going. It was really discussing, what we were discussing was then what they did when we went. It was hard to give them advice. Similarly with the Australian Navy, the one worried less there, that was a bigger organisation. But I remember with the Australian Navy discussing something that never happened, that with the removal of our influence from Singapore, and that they shouldn't move west a certain amount of their... All their navy was east, Melbourne, Sydney. Nothing in the west to speak of. That whether they shouldn't perhaps build up at Perth and have a naval base on that side. They never did, as far as I know, and never have, probably never will. I don't suppose it was necessary anyway, but I remember that was one of the key discussions from after our departure. My wife and I had a lovely day yachting in Sydney Harbour in the most enormous boat owned by some colossally wealthy man. We must have been with all the best people in Sydney on that boat. I don't know who they were, but they all called each other darling, I remember. That meaningless expression of affection that the smart people have. And they were no different in Sydney. But it was a lovely boat to sail. I enjoyed sailing that boat. And then from Sydney, we inexcusably, and nobody noticed and nobody stopped me, we went to Alice Springs. What the hell does an admiral have to do in Alice Springs? The only excuse I could find to answer this is that they did have a race. There's a dry bed of a river in Alice Springs, and they do have a sort of canoe race with people with their feet through the bottom of the canoe running along the dry bed. But that was an interesting place to see, obviously. And on from there to Perth. I love Perth. I thought it was very attractive. The mineral boom that followed in Western Australia simply hadn't taken place then. Perth was relatively unspoiled. It was still a Victorian town with shops lowly built buildings with shops with sort of verandas all along the pavement. I expect there's some left, but not much. There were very little high rise. It was a most charming place. And, of course, the countryside around and the Swan River is absolutely lovely. We stayed with the governor we'd stayed with the governor in Victoria, Jumbo Delacombe, Major General Jumbo Delacombe, a lovely man. Jumbo Delacombe was really a gloriously old-fashioned, proper colonial governor. And curiously enough, the Australians of Victoria seemed to love it. They all the ladies bobbed to him, and he did it terribly well. They asked him to stay on. They liked him so much. But he was a proper old buffer, and such a nice one. And they loved it. Lived in the most beautiful house. It was the governor of Western Australia was a Major General McKendrew, another British Army officer, who was much less attractive, I found. His wife always referred to him as A.G., and I couldn't think who she was talking about. But he must have a Christian name, but she never seemed to use it. A.G. this and A.G. that, which I always find very boring. But we enjoyed our stay with the Australian Navy. the representative there was a commodore who had been a midshipman in the Mediterranean in HMS Ramillies when I was in HMS Revenge. That's, of course, the nice thing about being in the service is that you just meet up again after all these years and can renew friendships, and we renewed a friendship with him, even though his name's escaped me at the moment. He became ultimately... quite interesting, because the next governor of Western Australia was a group captain, Royal Air Force, who won the VC, a great gallant airman, but unfortunately, by the time he became was sent as governor of Western Australia, he was on the bottle, and was an alcoholic. And Jim, I've got his Christian name anyway, this commodore really ran Western Australia and carried this governor along. And I'm glad to say Jim himself was subsequently made governor of the Northern Territories. So he received his... Although he wasn't promoted in his navy to admiral, which I thought he should have been, he got some recognition as the governor of Northern Australia. That was one lovely visit. And we obviously went to Honolulu, where Saint Pat Fleet was an admiral called Johnny Highland, a nice bald-headed man who had a wife called Floss, and we were put in an extremely nice sort of guest house while we were there, and in fact had our 25th wedding anniversary in Honolulu, and in consequence we had all sorts of flowers hung round our neck at every party we went to. Indeed, the British Consul gave us a sort of anniversary party, which was very nice of him. And one slight amusing thing was, we wanted to go to Mass on that day, on this wedding anniversary, and went into the naval base where the Catholic chaplain said a Mass for us. And we were the only congregation, plus one small boy who was a altar server. And my wife's just coming in. The priest said to the altar server, "Yes, these are Admiral and Mrs. O'Brien. They've been 25 years married. This is Admiral." And all that happened was that this boy, I can't do it, made the biggest wolf whistle I've ever heard. You know, by God Almighty, fancy that. I had two ships in Honolulu, so I had some presence there, HMS Fiji and HMS Glamorgan.
What was their function?
Oh, just to... can't be an HMS Fiji. There isn't such a ship. it's gone, the name of the ship. But two DLGs, guided missile destroyers. Indeed, I'd come in ceremoniously in them. I flew up, when they arrived, they sent a helicopter in to pick me up, and I flew out to... I've got to tell you what it is, haven't I? Anyway, I came in officially with my flag flying in her, and we were greeted officially with gun salutes and all the rest of it, but unofficially with one of the most ghastly sights I've ever seen. The American Wives Organization dressed themselves up in hula skirts, and with a loudspeaker on the van with a tape recorder inside it, blasting away on "Good Night, Hello Honolulu" or whatever. They did a hula dance on the jetty to greet us, and it was absolutely terrible to see these rather unshapely, I'm afraid, wrong-coloured ladies in strange rush skirts doing a hula hula to this awful music, which was blasted out, such bad reproduction, you know, rather like a man with a tannoy at his mouth. Terrible. But they meant well, it was very kind, but it was pretty awful. And that was a sort of aloha to greet us. All the Americans in Hawaii greet you with aloha, as though they themselves are Hawaiian. Johnny Highland was a very nice little man, and as I say, treated us extremely well. I don't think we, again, I really had nothing to discuss with him there, but I'm sure we discussed it.
So really the point of the visit is really to make personal contact.
Yes, make personal contact. You knew, so you knew your chaps, yes. He took us down to to the beach, and we tried to pretend we knew how to surf and fell off it all the time. As he drove us across the island, we kept off on passing places with Dillinger, D-I-L-I, Dillinger written on it, the Dillinger Corporation. And I said to Johnny one time, what? Dillinger Corporation, what are they exactly? He said, oh, Admiral, they came here as missionaries. They came here to do good, and they did very well indeed. And they did the enormous business. As we drove around the island, Floss, Johnny Highland's wife, used to sit in the back of the car, telling backseat driving in the most appalling way. And the Admiral from the front would say, oh, cut it out, Floss, oh, cut it out, Floss. But Floss never cut it out. She was absolutely irrepressible. She was a nice lady, but talkative. No great things after that. I think we'll stop, shall we, at that?
Yes, if you'd like to. And then we can pick it up with presumably the end of your time as in the Far East Fleet.
Yeah.
Would you be happy with that?
Visit to Japan was quite interesting. I could give you that. We went. We flew to Japan, and again I had a ship there, as in order that I could have somewhere to entertain. That was part of the battle to return hospitality, and the ship, of course, could do it. And I've forgotten. It's terrible that I can't remember the names of any ships.
Well, don't worry about that. I was just going to ask you: Japan had what sort of navy, or were you really liaising again with the Americans in Japan?
No, not with the Americans. I did go down to Yokosuka and see them, but no, this was specifically Japanese. So we went. We were the guests of Admiral Ataya, the chief of naval staff, the Japanese. And all the arrangements were Japanese.
And what were relations like with the Japanese at this time?
Oh, very good. This is we're well away from the war, 68. Perfectly good. The most interesting thing I did in Japan was go to the Will Adams ceremony, which will be meaningless to anybody listening to this. Will Adams was a Kentish man who was a navigator of or whatever it was called then, the master, I suppose, of a Dutch ship which went to Japan in the late 16th century. Mid-16th century. The expedition left Europe before the Reformation, roughly, and arrived in Japan after it, and this is quite important. They were wrecked on the shore there, and all were locked up, because the Japanese weren't exactly friendly in those days with Europeans. But several of them survived all this, and the Japanese learnt that this chap was a shipbuilder, or was a carpenter, or was skilled anyway, and they employed him. And Will Adams is the progenitor of the Japanese Navy. He started to build ships in Yokohama, and he was looked after by the Japanese Shogun, I suppose, anyway, the emperor, whatever. Indeed, he himself was made a shogun eventually. He married a Japanese and lived very contentedly. Not all the other survivors did quite so well. They were apt to get on the drink and make a fool of themselves and annoy the Japanese and get killed. But Will Adams saw it all through and became a protege of the emperor. And when he died, they buried him with all ceremonial on a little hill, mountain almost, at Yokosuka, near Yokosuka. And every year to this, now still to this day, I'm sure, they have a ceremony, the Will Adams ceremony, and we happened to coincide with it, so I was invited. And there were rather large Japanese ladies doing curious country dances. There was all the mayor and local council, the Japanese Navy there in strength, and everybody placing wreaths on the grave of this man, including me. I placed a wreath in the grave. Now, what was most interesting was the presence there at the ceremony of a Buddhist priest, a Catholic priest, and a Protestant minister, all at the ceremony, which is wonderfully sort of cooperative with the Japanese, who did not know, obviously, what this chap ultimately was, before the Reformation Catholic, after the Reformation Protestant, but he married a girl and lived as a Buddhist with her, so to speak. So he had all three. So I thought this was charming, and it was altogether a charming ceremony. I enjoyed the day. And there's a book you can get out of the public libraries which explain all the history of this chap. I can't remember its name, but it's Shogun, whatever his name was. Adams, Shogun Adams, I think is the name of the book, or English Shogun or something. But that was fun and very interesting. What was also fun was that I caught one of my commanding officers with his trousers down, because I had a destroyer in Yokohama at the same time as we were in Tokyo. And when I came down to Yokosuka for this ceremony, I dashed on board this ship to see the captain. And the ship was virtually empty. There was a youngster on the gangway who hadn't the remotest idea who or what I was, totally baffled. Did nothing, called nobody, and so I said, don't worry. And I walked along the upper deck, and I went up the ladder, past the water, and I went to the captain's sea cabin and opened the door, and there was the captain, literally, just pulling on his trousers. I caught one of my captains actually with his trousers down. Poor man, he was terribly embarrassed. He was obviously coming to the ceremony, that's right, that's why I went to collect him. He wasn't ready. What else happened in Japan? Oh yes, I had a big lunch party on board at which Princess Chichibu came. Now, Princess Chichibu was the one member of the Japanese royal family who had remained totally Anglophile throughout everything and was well known very fond of our country, and everybody was very fond of her. She was absolutely sweet. She was a delightful guest. I can't remember who else was there, but she was obviously the principal guest at my lunch party. She died not many years afterwards. And that was the lunch party where a very, very young steward serving the potatoes as he was going round and serving my wife, and she only took one potato, and this youngster, who was about 18 years old, leaning over my wife with his head just near her ear, whispered, dieting to my wife. When she told me this story, she made me promise that when she told me this story, I would not tell the captain, and I never did. So Captain Kitchen, Royal Navy, never heard that one of his stewards had made this dreadful remark to his fleet commander's wife in her ear.
Shall we stop there and pick the rest of your story, both your Japanese, the conclusion of your Japanese visit and the conclusion of your time in the Far East? Mm. I think this might be an opportunity.
Yep, that's fine. There's not much more to say, I think, about the Far East, probably.
I probably will have a couple of questions, but I'll leave those until we meet next time.
Thank you very much.